I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE, host of the most recent International COP Climate Conference. Given the evidence, only a fool could deny that the world is warming and that global policymakers need to do something about what late capitalism is doing to life on Earth. But is there an imminent tipping point? Are individual climactic events or years or decades relevant when judging how far gone is the planet? Or are scientists becoming slaves to a totalitarian system designed to prevent science? Let alone all of us comprehending how climate change threatens us and climate change policy threatens the poorest people on Earth. Award-winning climatologist and president of the Climate Forecast Applications Network, Professor Judith Curry, has a different perspective to the one you'll find on NATO-aligned media. She was the chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology for over a decade. In her latest book, Is Climate Uncertainty and Risk Rethinking Our Response? She joins me now from Reno in Nevada. Professor Curry, thanks so much for coming on. It's such a detailed, scholarly book, but presumably it's going to help people if they're turning on the news and there's been a hurricane, a wildfire, an earthquake, anything. And the way the so-called mainstream media will talk about it will all be in terms of this is because you're, I don't know, not recycling enough? Your governments are not doing enough to combat climate change? Explain why... people have to be very wary when watching the news.
Well, the main thesis of my book is that we have vastly oversimplified both the climate problem and its solutions. The weakest part of the argument is whether warming is even dangerous. And, you know, this was assumed way back, you know, in the late 1980s as the UN picked up on this issue, you know, to put forward, you know, a globalist agenda. And so the science has been, actually the policy cart has been way out in front of the scientific horse for decades now on this issue. And the problem's been very narrowly framed. It's this narrow framing about it's only about fossil fuel emissions has acted to marginalized important fields of climate science, and it's led to us making extremely suboptimal decisions about how we should deal with the problem in terms of eliminating emissions.
So obviously, as the climate warms, poorer areas will get richer and richer ones will get poorer, perhaps. But why is it there is this consensus? I mean, Noam Chomsky, who's been on this show, wrote Manufacturing Consent, about how wars are have to have consent manufactured for us to support them. You talk in your book how the International Panel on Climate Change manufactures consensus. 97%, you quote the Obama, the butcher of Libya, arguably. Obama tweet, 97% of scientists agree climate change is real, man-made, and dangerous. So 97%.
Okay, well, there's a very big difference between a scientific consensus and a consensus of scientists. You know, something like the Earth orbits the sun, that's a well-known fact. You don't need to talk about consensus. When you hear talk about consensus, it probably means that some politicians are, you know, looking for scientific evidence that will support their preferred policies. And towards that end, I mean, the IPCC was asked to seek consensus about climate change to support the UN climate agenda. And in order to do so, they carefully selected people who would, you know, promote this particular idea. They completely marginalized natural climate variability. And in order to enforce a consensus, they had to demonize anybody who challenged it. You know, they became called deniers or whatever. So it's just a very bad situation, not just for science, but also for policymaking. The so-called manufacturing of scientific consensus to support political objectives.
I understand, perhaps, why scholars in rich countries might want to do this for preferment. I understand why politicians might want to encourage this. Al Gore, famously, $560 million from the U.S. Energy Department for his companies while he was writing his books, urging the importance of something must be done about climate change. But why in poorer countries? Because you've written eloquently about how, say, a continent like Africa suffers under the dictatorship of the IPCC movement, as it were, so that they cannot develop while the rich countries, rich people in rich countries, get very wealthy off these policies.
Well, international development aid for the last several decades has been tied to the climate change agenda to eliminate fossil fuel emissions. Money that used to be used to eradicate, try to eradicate poverty and reduce vulnerability to extreme weather events and help eliminate world hunger. I mean, all of that is now ignored in the zeal to eliminate fossil fuels. And, you know, there's 4 billion people on the planet, mostly in Africa, who don't have access to grid electricity. And while people in Africa, they do have abundant coal and petroleum resources, they need loans to build the infrastructure to actually use them to, you know, to develop grid electricity. And they can't get the loans, from European and world banks because they don't want to fund any fossil fuel projects. And so instead, they just essentially take the fossil fuel resources from Africa and ship it to Europe and Asia to support their energy consumption, you know, and it's a terrible thing. I mean, it's been called energy apartheid, green colonialism, whatever, but it's deeply immoral.
Yeah, and that isn't really mentioned by green parties in Western Europe. I remember talking to the leader of the British Green Party, who we interviewed on this program some years ago, and I mentioned that we were covering the leaks of emails confirming the politicization of science back in 2007. And she said, oh, that's not a good interview to do. You were part of the 2007 IPCC consensus yourself as a scientist. Just remind us about the emails and what caused and inspired your suspicions and your later work.
Well, circa 2009, I thought the responsible thing for a climate scientist was to support the IPCC consensus in public statements about climate change. Okay. But that all changed when I read those emails. This was ClimateGate, the unauthorized release of emails from the University of East Anglia involving a number of IPCC lead authors.
And people can watch our interview in the archives, actually, on our Rumble channel about with one of the people in the email chain.
Yeah. Well, it revealed efforts to circumvent Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to rig the peer review process, violating procedural guidelines for the IPCC, and generally trying to sabotage anyone who criticized their work or disagreed with them. And this is totally antithetical to what scientists are supposed to do. And so I started speaking out about that, saying we need to do better. We need to make all our data and our methods completely transparent, publicly available. We needed to be honest about uncertainty. We needed to avoid overconfidence in reporting our results. And finally, we needed to treat with respect other people who disagreed with us.
What did you make of the investigation, though, that cleared all the scientists involved in that email chain of anything untoward?
Well, there was a lot of pressure. And these inquiries and investigations were very narrowly constrained. I mean, it was the people in the UK were off the hook for violating the Freedom of Information Act requests because the statute of limitations expired 6 months previously. You know, that kind of thing. They got off on technicalities. And people who were doing the investigations really wanted to support the UN and the IPCC, and they wanted this all to go away. So for the most part, the investigations were shallow and they were whitewashes. So they weren't convincing at all to anyone who actually looked what those reports said. And a number of the committee members on those inquiry panels spoke up publicly about how shallow these investigations actually were.
And of course, the way the IPCC mafia work is, if you don't agree, you get attacked. So I suppose we better get this out the way. How you see, you are a big oil, big gas funded scholar yourself. How did you have to answer that? And is that what happens to all scholars maybe watching this show? If they want to express skepticism, is what lies ahead for them?
I never received funding for my research from, you know, the petroleum sector. In 2006, I started a private sector company, Climate Forecast Applications Network. I wanted to apply weather and climate research to helping people make better decisions. I did have some clients in the energy sector. I mean, they were interested in better hurricane forecasts, better electricity load demand forecasts, this kind of thing, nothing to do with climate change. But nevertheless, I mean, the simplest way, these activists who were preaching the consensus and talking about deniers didn't really want to engage with any skeptics about their actual arguments. They felt the easiest way to tar them was to say, oh, well, they're being funded by fossil fuel industry, and then we could therefore dismiss them. But to my mind, at least in the US, government funding is far more biased and resulting in more politicization of the scientists than the very paltry amounts of research funding from the petroleum sector. So that whole argument doesn't make sense, but it's an easy way of just completely dismissing anybody who challenges any of the science or the policies.
And one of the fundamental axioms that all this environmental industry uses is high confidence based on, quote, moderate evidence. And it's accompanied by increasing CO2 levels since the COP conferences started, and every single target not met, every single deadline not met.
Well, you know, climate change, you know, the climate system is extremely complex, and our understanding is of this is deeply uncertain. There is a whole lot that we don't know, and even more that we can't know, just because of fundamental chaotic nature of the climate system. So these overconfident predictions with inadequate climate models are just fundamentally not fit for purpose for making policy decisions about the energy system. But that doesn't stop the politicians from completely relying on them.
Professor Judith Curry, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the president of the Climate Forecast Applications Network and author of Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response, Professor Judith Curry. We were talking in part one about the way evidence is used. So the actual data that then filters down to the general public as they vote for these politicians who support ideas that you say aren't based on science. We talked a bit about financial conflicts. I want to go back to that. But explain the process of data laundering and spin, given, as you were saying at the end of part one, there are lots of things we don't know mathematically yet to produce the kind of conclusions being bandied about in normal discourse as absolute truths.
Well, you know, what the public consumes here is carefully laundered spin, and here's how it happened. Okay, so you take a research paper with, you know, ambiguous conclusions, but they will sort of make the abstract and the title provocative so that they will get some attention and some press and some media attention. So, but if you read deep into the paper, there's a lot of caveats and uncertainties. And then you go to the level of the IPCC. They select papers that are convenient to their conclusions, and they ignore a lot of ones that are inconvenient. In the body of the IPCC reports, there's some good material and some good analyses. But by the time you get to the summary for policymakers, you know, this has all been spun. The results have been cherry-picked and carefully crafted to support the preferred narrative. And then once you have the UN officials talking about the IPCC reports, we have code red, highway to hell, you know, all of this kind of crazy rhetoric. And then the media takes it from there with all of this alarming rhetoric. So by the time the public actually sees it, they're exposed to a bunch of unjustified, overhyped alarm that is not supported by the science or even by the text of the full IPCC reports themselves.
And this isn't the climate change itself, is it? It's about papers to do with tipping points, to do with explanations. It can be about specific incidents and areas of science.
Oh, yeah, you know, what we hear about every extreme event, extreme weather event, you know, a hurricane, a flood, a heat wave, whatever, is now blamed on fossil fuel emissions, which is completely unjustified. Even the IPCC acknowledges that there's no change in extreme weather events with the exception of the slight increase in the intensity of heat waves and a reduction in the intensity of cold waves. That isn't surprising with an overall increase in global temperature. But, you know, hurricanes, hail, tornadoes, floods, droughts, all of this, there isn't any signal of a change from the warming. And you would never believe that if you listen to the media.
You'd never expect the European Union, which is backing wars in the Middle East, in Ukraine, to come out with something like a precautionary principle, given it's using a lot of fossil fuels in all these wars. But, you know, the precautionary principle is in the treaties of the European Union. Why do you have no time for the precautionary principle and probably think the precautionary principle actually poses greater dangers than not having one?
Okay, for a very tame problem, simple problem, like some food additive or something like that, you know, it might be a problem. It might cause cancer. Okay, we'll get rid of it, you know, and nobody is really bothered. But when you're talking about something as complex as a climate system and as fundamental to human well-being and development as the energy system, which is currently driven by fossil fuels, simplistic application of the precautionary principle, saying, well, it's warming, it's caused by carbon dioxide emissions, therefore eliminate carbon dioxide emissions, which means fundamentally transforming our energy and even our food systems, and we need to do this by 2030, makes absolutely no sense. And, you know, it's not only is it technologically infeasible, it's immensely expensive and politically unviable. And why they persist in pushing with this agenda, I mean, they're running into the hard wall of reality. And we saw hints of that at the recent CO2 meeting in Dubai.
Is it a testament to the way the IMF and World Bank system works then that so many in the global south have embraced exactly these ideas of impoverishing their countries as a sort of way to enter the international community at the expense of their own populations?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of agendas and factors in play. You know, one is a worldview that the environment is fragile and humans are a blight on the planet, therefore we need to reduce population and all that.
And this is the Malthusian view that there are too many people.
Exactly. And the other thing is, you know, a UN agenda, a longstanding UN agenda for, you know, non-governmental world control through organizations like the UN. And the UN very early picked up on the environment and health issues as being the two agendas that could, you know, the two issues that could forward that agenda. And they've been running with the environmental one for decades now. And with the
I'm not sure it's the UN. I mean, it's presumably there's a lot of money involved in this. Hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, maybe, by the scale of the need to completely realign the energy systems of Western Europe and the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, that they're playing on fear that people have. I mean, they've overhyped, you know, the alarm, you know, saying that we could have 10 degrees centigrade of warming by 2100 is completely ridiculous. And even the UN now recognize that's completely ridiculous. They're talking about maybe 1 to 2 degrees more warming by the end of the 21st century. I mean, this is something new from the UN since about 2021. But you'd never believe that from what you hear in the media. So, you know, by linking, I mean, we have three separate issues. One is extreme weather. The other one's a slow creep of climate change. And the third one is energy, electric power, and transportation. And by conflating all those three things under the climate change umbrella, saying that a little bit of warming demands that we dismantle our energy and food infrastructures in the interests of eliminating CO2 emissions makes, you know, it's a very poor choice driven by the precautionary principle, which is completely unsuited for a complex and deeply uncertain problem like climate change. And the intersectionality of extreme weather and our energy systems.
And renewables for you are too carbon intensive in the sense that so many fossil fuels are required to create the windmills and solar power in the main as a complete transfer. But I want to get onto the Goldilocks dilemma. Why is that central to all this? What is it?
Okay, well, I mean, people say, oh my gosh, you know, we've already had 1 degree of warming and we could see another several degrees of warming by 2100. Well, over that century where we saw 1 degree of warming, we saw the global population increase by about 400%. Far fewer people are living in poverty than before. Agricultural productivity has skyrocketed, and a far smaller percentage of the population die from weather and climate extreme events.
You said poverty has increased, you know, though. You meant decrease.
And this is why we've already had 1 degree temperature increase. You know, we've done fine with that first 1 degree of temperature increase.
Sorry, you said poverty has increased or decreased with the 1 degree?
Oh, yeah, poverty has decreased. I'm sorry, has drastically decreased. I'm sorry, I must have misspoke. And the other thing is, if you go back to pre-industrial, you know, the 1700s, the 1800s, it was cold. This was the end of the little ice age. This was the coldest period of the last 1,000 years. And why would we think that this was good? I mean, there were famines. Agricultural productivity was way down. There were lots of extreme weather events, crazy droughts, and so forth and so on. And why anyone would think that was a good climate, I don't know. But humans have always adapted to their weather and climate. And if they have enough energy and wealth, they will continue to do so.
Well, you see, that's where it turns into a bit, and you footnote Hayek in it, market forces. What are we supposed to do, knowing that climate change is coming? What is everyone supposed to do, given that presumably it will impoverish some richer prairies and areas of farmland, whilst poorer countries clearly that have been colder will get warmer and be really lucrative for crop cultivation that weren't before?
Well, we don't know how climate change is going to play out. Regional climate change depends far more on natural climate variability related to multi-decadal regimes of ocean circulation patterns. I mean, it's not a simple trend in one direction. So, I mean, the best way to approach this is more of a bottom-up approach, not the UN top-down approach, where each country, each region works to understand their weather and climate vulnerabilities and works to increase their resilience and, you know, works to develop a 21st century energy infrastructure that will be more abundant, more reliable, more secure, more inexpensive, and preferably green. I mean, once you put the decision making down at the lower levels, I mean, you can end up with some sensible actions. But instead, we have, whenever anything goes wrong, people just throw up their hands and say, we can't do anything. It's global warming, it's fossil fuel, it's climate change. And they use that as an excuse for not dealing with their real problems.
Yeah, I'm not sure with the United States at all but war with China and Russia. They want all these cold expanses to become urban places of economic prosperity as this progresses, this global warming. What are these other factors here? And what influences these scientists? And I suppose, what do you think of journalists then while this process of, lying to the public has gone on since the Paris summit?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lots of factors that influence climate. Land use is a big one. It influences our local climate. There's external factors like volcanoes and solar variations. And there's internal factors like internal variations, natural variations in the large scale ocean and atmospheric circulations. And these are the big drivers of climate change on seasonal to decadal, even multi-decadal timescales. Global warming is a slow creep that influences sea level rise, the slow creep of sea level rise, and the slow melting of glaciers. By pretending that every extreme weather event is caused by the slow creep of warming, just makes us, you know, it leads us to ignoring the real causes of our vulnerability, which would be, you know, inadequate infrastructure, poor emergency management, poor water resource management, and things like that. Instead, we throw up our hands and blame everything on global warming.
Professor Judith Curry, thank you.
Thank you, my pleasure.
And climate uncertainty and risk. Rethinking Our Response is out now. That's it for the show. Remember, we're bringing you new episodes every Saturday and Monday. But until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you soon.